What's up, everybody, and welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning! Yeah!
Ooh, I'll buy that for a dollar. And today, we're talking about RoboCop, the 1987 film directed by Paul Verhoeven, starring Peter Weller. As always, we're going to go around and get people's first impressions. What was it like the first time you watched it, and what was it like revisiting this movie for the podcast? Let's start with Ryan, my good friend. What do you think? What are your thoughts on RoboCop?
Dude, I love fucking RoboCop, man.
Of course
Paul
you do. Yeah.
Paul Verhoeven is top five filmmakers for me. And wow. This is one of his best, you know. And it was amazing watching it this time and kind of seeing his similarities or his through lines through other movies. Like, there's so many things that Starship Troopers in this movie have in common.
Totally.
With the cutaways to the kind of satirical news segments and whatnot, and then just the whatever you want to call it, futuristic military technology in the film. And the co-ed shower scene is in both. With that, you know, there's not in very many only Paul Verhoeven would have a co-ed shower scene in more than one film. I love the shit out of this movie. It encompasses so many cool or just very relevant things for a movie that was made in, what, 1984 or so? Or, no, shit,
1987.
But it does it in a way that could have been so cheesy. And it is a little cheesy, but like his movies, but they're kind of over the top in a way. But they're over the top in a way that I love because they actually have heart and they have characters and real things that they're talking about while also smiling and being light in a way. So you know, this is about super deep, hardcore, intense themes that could be also very heavy. Like the remake of RoboCop is way heavier and unsuccessful, in my opinion. It just kind of takes the, you know, all of the intense themes that this movie is about: police brutality, police unions, police strikes, AI, you know, a religion, and it kind of makes a more serious version of it. Which, you know, I'm not saying that's, you know, there could be a movie that requires that, but what I love about this movie is the his take on it, the lightness of it, of the style and the aesthetic, while also having a really deep message that I think is important too, and also saying a lot about the future and kind of, you know, and here we are, what, 20, 30 years later, and I don't know, I feel like we'll talk about it, but it's a pretty relevant movie.
Yeah, amazing. Austin, what about you? I know you were super psyched to do this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen this since I was a kid. Right. And as a kid, I watched it a lot. And for some reason, the scene that is like ingrained into my brain is the one where at the end, when the one bad dude gets like deformed in the toxic waste or whatever.
Oh, it becomes the toxic Avenger for a second.
You know,
yeah.
Like, for some reason that like scarred me as a child because he's so. And like when someone mentions RoboCop. Obviously, I think of Murphy, but then I also think of that dude, like,
and I don't know why. His fingers just melting off.
Yeah, and there's such great, like, body horror in this film, too, right? Like, such interesting stuff. But as a kid, I obviously didn't realize that this was a satire. I just thought that, like, it was a badass machine man, which, like, why do little boys in particular, like, why do we love fucking, like, cyborgs and machines and robots? Like, as a kid, I was like, that's
badass,
so cool. He's like part human and part machine. Like, that's amazing. So I fucking loved it. So I didn't realize. I mean, I knew obviously from commentaries and stuff that it was a satire. But having watched it now through the lens of it being a satire, I have an even deeper appreciation for the film. I think it's everything that Ryan said, I concur with. I think the way that it's shot, we just don't make movies like this anymore too. You know, there's something about the 80s with practical effects. Big explosions, the clear goodies and the baddies. I mean, actually, though, this film, because bro, is Murphy a goodie? Is the like kind of like what is the good? What is the goodness in the film that we can like talk about? You know, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But there's like the clear like stereotypical bad guys that are just bad, right? They're just bad through and through. And I really like that. And the way that it's shot, I think it's a fantastic film. I really love it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. I actually saw this movie for the first time probably within the last 10 years. I remember when I was a little kid, I had this misguided thought that, oh, well, if RoboCop 3 is out, they only keep getting better, so I'm just going to watch the third one. Like, why do I need to watch the first and second ones? So I saw RoboCop 3 like 4 or 5 times when I was a kid, and I'm talking about, you know, maybe like less than 10 years old. And I – so – I revisited RoboCop for the first time, and I kind of got the satirical elements to it, but the thing that I always focused on, and I guess that always initially strikes me in Paul Verhoeven films, is the hyperviolence.
Yes.
And I remember the first time that the I can't remember exactly what the machine is called, like the Ed something.
The ED. The ED or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't there something great, too, the ED? I mean, I don't know if this was intentional, but it's also how we describe erectile dysfunction. So, like, is this like man overcompensating for his impotency or something?
And everyone's favorite car is the 6000 sucks.
Yeah, the 6000 sucks.
Yeah, there's definitely something going on there. But this time, just like what Ryan mentioned, I definitely glommed on more to the interstitials with the guy who says, "I'll buy that for a dollar," and the 6000 SUX, and then the news pieces where they say like 10,000 acres of land were evaporated because a space military weapon malfunctioned.
113 people dead, including two ex-presidents.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, just the world that they build is so grim, but it's not really painted as a grim world. And he does the same thing as Starship Troopers. And I've never really appreciated Paul Verhoeven for these things that I've been learning about him since doing podcasts on Starship Troopers and now this film. I just thought of him as a straight-up action director.
Like a John McTiernan, like Die
Yeah,
Hard,
something like that.
Predator kind of guy.
So I'm kind of having a new love affair with Paul Verhoeven.
I have a buddy who just recently went through and watched all of his non-English speaking films,
yeah,
like Turkish Delight.
Yeah, I've got to see his Dutch movies. I haven't seen one of them.
I hear they're supposed to be really interesting. So, yeah.
That's what I hear, too.
Is Black Book one of those, or
no? That,
that's in English?
Well, that's way later. It is one of his Dutch movies. I guess I have seen that one, but that was way later. I think what your friend's probably talking about is his movies before Coming to Hollywood.
He made Turkish Delight and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So yeah, RoboCop, so awesome. So glad that I think it was Ryan's idea to cover this movie right now.
Yeah.
So without further ado, let's go into a recap. So a private company called OCP is brought in to run a struggling old Detroit police department, which has suffered many casualties at the hand of crime boss Clarence Boddicker. In order to clean the streets before they can start their plan to modernize the city, OCP decides to invest in the RoboCop program. When recently transferred cop Murphy is brutally murdered by Clarence and his gang, he's reborn as the cyborg supercop known as RoboCop. RoboCop has crooks on the run in old Detroit, but when he has a dream about his past, it leads him down a path of recognizing his past as Murphy and going rogue. RoboCop descends on Clarence's operation, and Clarence tells him that he works for Dick Jones, the number two at OCP. RoboCop tries to confront Jones, but his fourth program directive won't allow him to arrest senior officers of OCP. After a devastating battle, RoboCop is saved by his one-time partner, Lewis, and Dick Jones promises Clarence all the drugs and gambling territory in his new vision of the city, but first, he has to kill RoboCop. With Lewis's help, RoboCop repairs himself and, having reconciled with his humanity, takes out Clarence and reveals Dick Jones's treachery to the rest of the OCP board. When Dick gets fired, RoboCop's fourth directive becomes obsolete and RoboCop kills him. When a board member asks, "What's your name, son?" RoboCop replies, "Murphy." End of movie.
Such a touching moment.
It is a touching moment.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I want to start off with what Austin asked about what is the good in this movie. I think that's kind of the meatiest question we have here. So what do you guys think?
What do you mean by that question? What is the good in this movie?
So RoboCop is obviously the protagonist. I mean, we follow him, especially when the second act starts. We start seeing that he's struggling with recognizing his humanity. He's struggling with reconciling his past and identifying as a human. And then, so we're rooting for him. But at the same time, RoboCop, especially with his fourth directive, I think represents something corrupt about policing in that they're often working at the hands of corporate interests and stuff like that. So when I say what's the good in this movie, is there even any good in this movie? Or is it just like a stark dystopia that's kind of painted over with kind of fun action sequences and a kind of levity that Starship Troopers also has?
Yeah, I wonder if we could say that the good is the human, right? And that all of the stuff that's pitched as being bad is all stuff that humans have created. It's all like the technologies and the tools of humanity that have gotten out of hand, right? Corporations have gotten out of hand. The city has gotten out of hand. Crime is the response because you have corporations that have been trying to degrade the city so that they can rebuild the city, but then crime has gotten out of hand. And then, of course, corporations try to build military technology. That's gotten out of hand. It kills, you know, innocent people. And then even with ED, it kills the human. And then even with RoboCop, it's kind of like before the humanity starts to spark in his imagination from that dream, right? He's just like this pure mechanical direction-taking machine kind of, right? And again, it's like the tools of humanity all of a sudden become outside of human control. So what's the good is it's almost like it's when Murphy starts to have that dream, then he can go on his personal mission of revenge, right? But that's when he has some semblance of freedom. There's some semblance of connection. And then, of course, I think Lewis is maybe the good in this, because she cares for Murphy while everyone else just sees him as a beast, as a Frankenstein monster. She sees the humanity in him. She's like, no, wait a second, this is Murphy. That's why it's so important. She's like, what's your name? And she's like, your name's Murphy, right? Like, because he still has that gun-twirling thing that signifies him as the father, as the husband. And it's those things, the kind of like simple elements of humanity that I think are supposed to be the good in the midst of this societal structure that humans built that kind of take on their own form, that's the bad, you know?
Yeah, I think the film is really smart in how it hints at the importance of the human part. So I think I like that the thing that kills the ED robot, or it doesn't kill it, but when it's facing off against RoboCop, what disarms it is its inability to descend stairs, because it's the man part that RoboCop, you know, gives him the advantage, or I guess more of the cop part. And then he keeps his dome off in the final battle, you know, showing off his human face and kind of relishing in that. Sorry, Ryan, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to go off what Austin was saying. And to me, it's very much two kind of stories going on. You got the whole, what is it? What is a human being in the face of AI and you know, what do you call it? Transhumanism and whatnot. And then you have the whole police theme and stuff. And the police theme is very, I don't think there's an answer at the end of the police theme. I think it's just satirical. Like, here's a future where, if you know, that we can end up at if we let private policing and all this other kind of stuff go get too out of hand. And I don't think that they really get Paul Verhoeven gives us an answer. It's just like, look at this mess. Do you want to live in that? And then, but then it's the other part. He does kind of. He's very adamant about this is a Jesus story. How, you know, Peter Weller or Murphy was killed. He was crucified by human beings, you know. And then he comes. He's resurrected as RoboCop, and he's this humanity savior, or whatever. And that's a very different story. That I think that at the end, it's it all kind of culminates in him saying, hey, what's your name, boy? And it's like, oh, my name's Murphy. Like I remember who I am, you know. What do you guys think about just the two? Do you guys think there's an answer to the police problem in this movie?
Well, sometimes you need like an outside perspective to really get a good satire on like a domestic problem, right? So he's European, and I've spent a lot of time, obviously I lived in Europe for a very long time. I live in Australia now. I spent a lot of time with Europeans, and one of the things they constantly ask me is, like, what's up with Americans and guns, bro? Like, what's up with your military? That's, like, the first thing they ask, and it's always a very difficult thing to try to explain to them how it's so kind of ingrained into the American ethos, right? To own guns, to shoot guns. So gun violence as being like this thing that is satirized is really handled well in the hands of a European man who's kind of like, I'm going to make a Jesus story and I'm going to make a satire on Reagan's America, because that's really what this is, 87, Reagan's America. I'm going to make a satire on this, but I'm just going to throw it in your face. Like, this is who you guys are, right? Like, that's kind of how I take it. Like, he's obviously intensifying it and making it more extreme, but he's like, this is who you are. Like, military, private corporations, greed, fucking drugs and hedonism, crime, violence, guns, crazy cops, out of control.
And you're all like, just acting like it's okay, you know?
And yeah,
like, oh,
and
yeah, this is our world.
That's right, because you have a nice car, or because you guys have like nice toys and you can own a home or whatever. He's like, but that's who you are. And it's like, like, here you go. And that's why it's such a great satire, because it's almost like, I'm not even going to make a serious critique. I'm just going to poke fun at you, and I'm just going to make fun at you so that you can laugh at how stupid you guys look. And that's why it's really interesting. So is there an answer? I don't think there's an answer, because I think the second point you made was absolutely right, that like, when things are so fucked up, do you have like a sit down program that you can offer as an alternative? Or do you just say, we just got to mock the shit out of you so that you can like kind of, it's a very postmodern kind of, there is no answer. It's kind of just a, let's just kind of throw a grenade in there and kind of blow things up. And
it's,
I think that's kind of what he's doing.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ryan just asked the question that, or he posed that Verhoeven is asking the question, do you want to live in that? And, but I think to take that a step further, it's more like, you do want to live in that, you sick fuck, don't you?
Yeah.
that's the tone that I get when I see those that commercial for the battleship-like game called Nukem by the Butler Brothers. And yeah, it's feels a lot like, would you like to know more about Starship Troopers? Because in that one, he's like, of course you do. Who wouldn't, you know? And in this one, he's like, do you want to live in that? Do.
It's the gamification of the crazy militaristic mentality. It's like, fuck yeah, it's exciting and it's cool and you can be the hero and you can be the destroyer or whatever. And yeah, that's exactly right. And in a way, I guess then what you could say is, he's not then saying, do you want to live in this? He's already saying, you already do live in this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Mom, your troops are moving into Pakistan. What am I gonna do?
Nuke 'em.
Yeah. What do you guys think about? I guess this is kind of more to the same point about just the news indicates to us that we're living in a very war torn world where there's constantly violence going on. I mean, I think this is probably just exaggerated versions of our own world.
Oh yeah, totally.
And this is before Iraq 1, and this is before, obviously, Iraq 2, and then invasion of Afghanistan and shit like that. So this is a very prescient film in a lot of ways. Not to say that there weren't global conflicts going on in the 80s. Of course there were. But the scale at which they're pitched was very sort of kind of predictive. And I think it was because he's basically saying, hey, if you live by the sword, then you die by the sword. If you live by this militaristic mentality, this is the logical outcome, you know. And so on the news, they're talking about World War III and shit like that. And even though it hasn't coalesced in the sense that we kind of understood World Wars I and II, there's a sense in which we're living in a state of permanent war where private corporations are, you know, benefiting immensely from these wars. And the fact that Verhoeven was able to kind of satirize that as though this was some sort of future world in the 90s is kind of amazing, right? Because isn't this supposed to be set in the late 90s? It's kind of amazing that he had such a prescient vision, I think.
We are
the real Brady Bros.
Brady Brothers from the TV show Brady Bunch. I'm Barry Williams.
And I'm Christopher Knight.
I played Greg. And who are you again?
I played Peter.
We've decided that we're going to do a podcast around episodes of the Brady Bunch. We're going to use it as a prism to look back to our experience doing the show and why the Brady Bunch is still popular.
Have a sunshine day.
We are the real Brady Bros.
I, yeah, totally. And, I think on that note, one of the most prescient lines in the film is said by that crazy homeless guy, or not home, unemployed guy on the news, yes, when he's like, we're living in the land of the free, man. There's no guarantees. It's just the law of the jungle, dude. You know, where it's just like, okay, I guess that's how the everyman thinks of what it's like, hey, it's just the law of the jungle out here. What are you going to do? You know?
Yeah, it's kind of reduced to that Hobbesian state of nature, that life is nasty, short, and brutish, and when you don't have – and maybe there's a way you could say – again, as a European, someone who would kind of be comfortable with a nice welfare state when you don't have – especially in the 80s, right? When you don't have some sort of like centralized institution to kind of keep cohesion, when that kind of disintegrates and you just – put everything over to private corporations who are just out for their own benefit and things like that, then what ends up happening is that you do end up getting this degraded form of society where there is no control, there's no order, where it's just kind of chaos. And then that's why you need the police, right? And the police then are supposed to go in and restore the order, but the police are they serve private interests as well, right?
And so they're all conflicted. Humans.
Yeah, they're conflicted. But then, of course, you have the crime, so there's a conflict of interest because the crime lord, Kurtwood Smith, is that who plays the main boss? He is, Red.
It's half the cast of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
So, and then he's also funded by the same private people, right? But it's just like, but then again, the creation kind of gets out of your control, which is a very sort of Frankenstein-y theme again. Like even the crime syndicate is out of the control of the man who's trying to orchestrate it, right? So everything is kind of out of humanity's control when you try to tinker with things. But yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Speaking of Twin Peaks, if I could just take a second to ask Ryan, how are you doing?
don't take a second to ask how far I am into Twin Peaks season 2 in the middle of our podcast.
Season 3. Robocop. Season 3. Hey, you brought it
moving
up.
Moving on.
Do you guys think that in all Paul Verhoeven movies, when the violence is supposed to be, like when it's over the top, that it's supposed to be for a satirical purpose?
Oh, it's absolutely for emphasis. It's totally about, you know, in every other action movie, even in like John Wick or something, you know, you like people are just dead, you know, in 5 seconds it's over, whereas wash in it, you absorb in it, you're bathing in it, just to be, he wants you to say like every life, like this is what you are fucking, you know, laughing at or enjoying, this is your entertainment. But this is how brutal it fucking is, you know, and this is the suffering. And so he'll show that extra 50 blood swabs just to get that right in your face. And I love him for it.
He's a fetishist, man. Watch Showgirls, too. Like, even the sex in Showgirls, it's so over the top that it's not even horny anymore. Like, it's not like you watch it and you're like, for a moment, you're a little bit turned on. And then all of a sudden you're like, like when Elizabeth Berkley is in the swimming pool and she's fucking freaking out and like flopping around like
a tornado.
Yeah. You're like, that's not even sexy anymore. That's just like over the top hedonism. So I think he loves to push what we think we want, like the desires. And he's like, I'm going to fucking give it to you up to 11 to use Spinal Tap. Right. And then when you do that, you're kind of like, okay, this is ridiculous. It's not sexy anymore. And it's not scary anymore with violence. Like when Murphy's hand gets blown off, like it's fucking like, it's like a geyser. It looks like that's not a human hand. Like that's clearly the most fake fucking prosthetic. And it's just gushing with liquid. And you're like, that is not what would happen, but it's kind of funny and ridiculous, and I think that's kind of on purpose. I dig it.
Did Rick Baker work on this film?
I don't remember. I feel like I'd remember that. I don't believe so.
Yeah, maybe not. But I mean, the makeup effects are amazing, obviously.
Steven.
Yeah.
Oh wait, no, never mind. Yeah, the makeup.
You know, I was gonna look that up too. I actually thought about that. I was gonna look up who did the practical effects, and then I didn't. So if there's someone in the live feed or something like that, let us know. I was going to say one thing about the kind of the cop issue that's so interesting is there is an angle to kind of like address, like obviously with certain concerns and things like that. But in this film, there is an angle of critique that comes more from a left perspective that says, well, the police essentially were formed to protect property relations, right? They're enforcing laws. Laws kind of emerge out of property law and other things like that. So that there's a sense in which police officers are there to enforce like certain power structures that already exist, pertaining to property relations, or what's sometimes referred to as bourgeois property relations, right? So there's a sense in which the police itself is already constituted under the influence of private corporations. So then that's the question, right? Is if we take that and we take that in the landscape of RoboCop, you have something similar there. It's just not subtle. It's like, no, you're actually owned by a private corporation, right? A particular private corporation. And then the question is can humanity like overcome that? Can you have a good cop? Can you have unions that go on strike because they don't like the conditions where they're in? And can you have some semblance of the human that transcends outside of these external pressures of private influence and corruption and stuff like that? And can humanity, is there something pure about the human that can transcend? And I think for Verhoeven, I think maybe in his like kind of cynical way, I think he thinks yes, that there is something about the human. There's something about the human that has love, that has compassion, that has connection, that attaches to family, that is selfless. I think he does think that there is something about the human. The question is does that humanity, does it ever get to breathe? Does it ever get to live, right? Or is it kind of trapped within that symbiosis between the other elements, the structural and institutional elements, and then the quote unquote natural? I don't think he answers it, but I think that maybe he does hint at that. What do you guys think?
I wanted to talk more about, like, you know, you're describing his fourth directive, that any attempt to arrest an officer, the OCP will result in a system shutdown. What I love the most about this is that it's kept a secret, that not even he knows, not even RoboCop knows what his fourth directive is until somebody tells him. And I think that that's kind of like almost like a systemic issue literalized in a sense, because, in a sense, the cops aren't even aware that their conditions are dictated to them by interests that are alien to what they think they're trying to do.
Totally. Yeah. And I forget, yeah. How does he actually overcome it? Oh, it's because the guy gets fired.
Because he gets fired. Yeah. And more to that, I was almost wishing at some point that it was more like something about his humanity allowed him to overcome his programming. But it's such a funny moment that it's hard for me to say that I wish they did it otherwise.
And that's what he's programmed to do.
And that would be the cheesy way out that the American filmmaker would make, right? That, the humanity overcomes the struggle between man and technology and, the human spirit. But fucking the European pessimism, they're like, no, it's just the guy's still programmed. He's still working within his program. It's much more of like an integrated. I actually think it works really well within the context of the film. But I totally get you. You do think that like, is the humanity going to somehow emerge, that one day he's going to wake up and he's gonna be like, I am Murphy. I sense myself, or some shit like that. But he's not a Batman figure, right?
Yeah, it would certainly make the movie less grim, because right now nothing gets fixed. I mean, he still has that fourth directive programmed in him. He's still, protecting the interests of the corporations.
Yeah.
The programmers have been killed, the ones that told him to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we can assume. Well, I don't know. In RoboCop 2, does he still have that directive? I haven't seen RoboCop 2, maybe forever.
It's not that good, but I don't remember, honestly.
Apparently, they're making a sequel, like an actual sequel to the original RoboCop. That's what the screenwriter said in like 2018. So I don't know if it's going to go forward, but it's not going to have anything to do with the 2014 remake. It's going to be a direct sequel.
Or the old sequels?
Or the old sequels. No, it's going to be a direct sequel to the 87 RoboCop. I don't know if it's still going forward, but I know that it's in the works. That would be interesting to see if they kind of keep the satire, keep the world of the 87 RoboCop. And then what happens to Murphy? Like, what do you think happens to Murphy the day after? Like, what does he do now after he kills ED? And what does he do now?
I think he turns into a good RoboCop. You know, you got some bad RoboCops and good RoboCops. He's going to become a good RoboCop.
But, like, does he become, like, a fig? Like, is he, like, a Batman figure where, like, the crime bosses fear him around the city, and then the journalists, they hail him as, like, a hero, and then there's the debates about vigilantism versus the institution? Like, is that where the story goes?
I think he probably just upholds the status quo. That's what I would guess. Because... you know, you mentioned earlier that Verhoeven has said in interviews that this is like the American Jesus film, or that RoboCop is an American Jesus figure. And part of me also thinks that he's kind of saying, like, in his kind of satirical wink wink way, that, yeah, you guys, like, this is your savior, you know, fourth directive and all. This is what you guys love, you know?
And deserve.
Yeah, love and deserve, exactly. So it makes sense that by the end of the movie, nothing has really changed, that he's probably still there to preserve the status quo, that his humanity has not taken over and allowed him to go rogue and go bypass his programming.
Jared, it was you that said that, like, Starship Troopers, was it? Did we talk about how, like, you could watch this and then, or maybe it was Alec even in the writer's room that we're talking about this, but that, like, you can watch Starship Troopers and not get the satire at all? Was that you, Jared?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, that was me.
That was you. Yeah. Like, do you think, I mean, yeah, obviously with
I still maintain that, and a lot of people have given me shit for that.
Well, what about RoboCop?
You know, because, like, how could you not know? 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, the only things that I think are really in your face are some of those television commercials. You know, that's when it's, like, really in your face that it's a satire. But other than that, I mean, I feel like for, you know, most of my 32 years of living, I probably would have not seen the satirical elements.
Are you talking about Starship or RoboCop in this instance?
RoboCop.
Okay, yeah. To me, the scene that really makes it go front and center as a satire is the first boardroom scene when the ED-209, you know, just fillets that guy in front of everybody. And then and then immediately the two bosses are like, well, damn it, we're going to lose $20 million this year. Like, what the fuck? And it's like, it's that tone of just two, you know, of a guy bloodied in the background while they're fucking talking about, you know, the all the money they're gonna lose in contracts. Like, to me, that's where I go, okay, this is a 100% satire. He's making a big point here, and what does it say, you know? And here we are talking about it. But I also can see, I think that it's one of those things where when this movie came out and you're 10 years old and you watch it, you clearly don't get that shit. You see a robot cop and you're like, badass. And then you play with the toys of it and that's it. And then reality becomes the movie where you're just like, oh, badass, a RoboCop. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And, and then you see the over the top violence of the ED robot and you're just like, oh yeah,
fuck,
man,
yeah,
violence. That's just like, double your awesome.
Do you think it defeats, like, do you need to have effective satire that can't be mistaken for just being kind of cool and enjoyable? Do you need it to have the hook where you're like, hey, clearly this is social critique?
It all depends on your preference and your sophistication, maybe. I don't know how you'd put it, but like I like it when it's blurry, man. I like it when it's muddy and I have to fuck it and go, what is he fucking telling me right now? What does he believe? What do the people that wrote this believe, you know? Or is it just out there? I love that.
There's also something about how your satire kind of performs its own point if people don't get it, because even if you're watching Starship Troopers or you're watching RoboCop, if you don't get it, then the satire is just all the more delicious, you know,
right?
In that, because you're like ending the movie going, fuck yeah, RoboCop, he's my savior, or you know, fuck yeah, I want to learn more, I want to live in that society where they just, you know, kill these aliens indiscriminately. Either way, I think that if the message doesn't come through, it almost makes the message just all the more meaningful.
Totally. I think Fight Club has that quality too to it.
Yeah.
Is there like a weird perversion then that Verhoeven might even have with like contributing? Like, imagine a sea of 7 to 10 year old kids playing with little RoboCop action figures, and they're like, fuck yeah!
I think I had one,
and then I think I did too. And then like Verhoeven, this like European guy from the outside, is kind of like going, ah ha ha ha! See, you are
He's just
fucked
laughing
up.
To
yeah,
himself.
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, like, how fucked up is that?
It's awesome.
It is kind of awesome. It just makes him pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think that precisely goes back to that question that Ryan asked. That I don't think there's an answer in this film. I don't. I think you're left
to the cop problem.
Yeah, to the cop problem, to good versus bad, to humanity and technology. I don't really think there's an easy answer for any of it, you know? I read that like he was unsure about directing the film, and then his wife read it and was like, actually, this is a Frankenstein film. And he didn't get the undertones of that element when he first read the script. And then that, I think in his direction, he kind of shifted it more in that lane of it being a real Frankenstein film, a humanity and messing with nature kind of thing. And yeah. I think that's what makes the film have legs, right? I think is that right. Kind of like messiness that you get that it's told. But I think that's what's really interesting about this film is you are left with kind of like, what do you do? Like, do you stop modifying nature? Do you stop building cool technologies? Do you stop building cities? Do you stop, like, what do you do? Like, where does science stop inventing things just because it's going to be used for nefarious purposes? Like, what the fuck do you do? You know,
I honestly, on that point, I do think that there's that almost is part of his message or the world he's built, like, where everybody in this world exists and is a human being, which is a big part of the movie, and has their own interests at heart. Even the cops who are all kind of like, look, what the we're dying over here, you know, we're not getting our overtime pay, we're gonna strike, you know what I mean? And then you got the cop chief being like, well, what the fuck are you? You're not supposed to do that, you know, we're not a bunch of plumbers. And then you have the people and the politicians and the business guys that are all kind of serving their own self-interest, which is just life, you know. And so I think that he's kind of painting, you know, when you get into the systemic issues and stuff, I think that Paul Verhoeven's quick to remind you, you know, that we're all like, no matter what person you single out, they're a fucking human being at the end of the day with flaws and all, warts and all. Selfish, you know, people are obviously selfish and self-interested, and that everyone has their own stake and is playing their own game in this, and that no matter what, people are kind of fucked, so we got to all live together at the end of the day. I don't think he says that explicitly, but that's kind of, I don't know, my implication from it, where it's like, everyone here is human. Let's deal with that first, you know?
Yeah. That's why I'd really want to see his non-American films, because I wonder if he's as pessimistic about European culture, right? Like, or is he just kind of like America and the American hegemon in Starship Troopers? Because basically the like new global empire in Starship Troopers is just America intensified on a global scale, right? So I wonder if
interestingly, doesn't it take place in like
Buenos Aires and shit like that?
Yeah.
But it's kind of still all the American military. It's everyone speaking with an American accent, right? Like,
yes.
So
yes.
I wonder.
It's Beverly Hills 90210.
Exactly. And so is he saying there's something fucked up with the American empire? Its media, its military, its private corporations, its focus on individualism, stuff like that. Like, I wonder if that, and it's coming from a kind of European, more community. Yeah, go ahead, Ryan. What do you think?
I think Starship Troopers is more about the system in being inherently like, because everyone there in the movie is so gung-ho for what they've been told their whole life. It's more about the military industrial complex, quote unquote, you know, and just how like that breeds a culture. Whereas this, you see people that aren't on board. Like it's more of a mess. Society is more of a, even though there's bugs, you know, killing everyone in the thousands by Starship Troopers, it's more like society's more dirty, or it's just kind of more of a, it looks normal, but it's also futuristic, but I don't know, it's more of a shithole. And so I people realize that in the film, except for the news people who portray life as just like, oh, this is just everyday life. So I think there's both of those kind of things going on in this movie. But to me, Starship Troopers is more about just critiquing, like, you know, like we were saying, the military industrial complex.
I mean, before the second act of RoboCop starts, when RoboCop starts having these dreams and starts recognizing himself as a human being, I mean, I thought of this movie as simply just a critique of the system, because we have the, I don't know the actor's real name, but the Twin Peaks guy, he's like almost the main character throughout that whole first act. The guy who is trying to climb to the top of the corporation by allowing for, you know, the RoboCop system to be initiated within the Detroit Police Department.
Yeah, there's definitely the system being critiqued for sure. I didn't mean to imply that, but I don't know. It just seems like I feel like Starship Troopers is even a heavier satire in that regard, and just that people's behavior.
I can see that.
The thing that I think is so interesting too is you guys were talking about how the news with like that Nukem game and stuff like that. I love how everything is sponsored. right? Everything has like a corporate sponsor. And so like even the guy that's talking about like heart surgery and shit like that, he's like, oh, he's talking about this new model and he's trying to make it all sexy and cool, you can tell. And then at the very end, what does he say? He's like, he's trying to sell you on something, sell you, sell you, sell you. He's like, remember, we care for you. And it's such a good it's such a good analysis of how advertising works. It's like, we're going to sell you this product because we actually care about you. Now buy our shit. Buy our shit. And it's a way of selling happiness, or like libidinally seducing us into wanting it, because it's like, oh, I can be fulfilled and I can get connection and empathy or whatever else. And I think that's kind of really important too, because that's what's cut in and out of those news things all the time, is that they are advertisements, that there's always this like corporate brand that is behind everything. And if you have a society that is just branded, like the whole society is run by brands and intellectual property and patents and all these levers that are behind the scene, then this is what you end up getting. You get people who want to play a violent military game. You get people who are invested, like libidinally invested into these things. And I think that's something else that Verhoeven's got. I think he's obsessed with sex in a lot of ways too, because you have that dude on TV that's like got those two women.
Two
and
girls.
Yeah, and he's like horny all the time. There's always an enjoyment in what Verhoeven is doing, like a sexual enjoyment in everything, you know?
Yeah, totally. God, what a badass.
For real. What's your favorite Paul Verhoeven, real quick, Jared?
You know,
Total
I'm really
Recall,
not
Basic Instinct. You know, we got Starship Troopers.
I would say I probably like this movie a little bit more than I like Starship Troopers, so I might even say RoboCop.
Wow.
What about you?
Fuck yeah. I'm probably going to go Starship Troopers 1, RoboCop 2, then probably Showgirls and Basic Instinct after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
No love for Total Recall?
Total Recall. I love Total Recall.
Oh, I like Total Recall.
Yeah, probably 5, but yes.
I feel like for me,
that's a remake I did see.
The one with Colin Farrell? Was it good?
One. Yeah, the one with Colin Farrell. No, it wasn't.
Okay, I didn't think it was. I chose not to see it because I knew it wouldn't be good. Like for me, Verhoeven, I haven't seen obviously any of the previous films before he came to Hollywood. So for me, it's all the ones we just mentioned. I feel like RoboCop is kind of in a class by itself. There's just something so unique about it. But then in the rest of that top 5 that you just mentioned, the Basic Instinct, the Total Recall, the Starship Troopers, Showgirls, they all kind of are tied for second. And I mean that in a good way. Like I think I enjoy, it's hard for me to, like I really enjoy them all and it's really just my mood. I think that Showgirls totally gets misunderstood. I think it totally gets misunderstood.
I got to watch it because I've never seen it.
Oh my God, Jared. Bro. I can't wait for you to watch that movie.
Oh my God.
Holy shit.
I've heard things, man.
You got to see it. We got to do a fucking movie on
We got to do it. We got to just keep the Verhoeven train going on this podcast because it is insane, dude. Yeah.
Dude, Austin, have you seen Ellie?
Which one?
Have you seen Ellie? His latest movie.
That's the latest one. So here's the thing. Everyone told me that it's brilliant, and I just fucking forgot to see it. I hear it's amazing. Yeah?
It's intense. It's something
I know,
else.
Like,
isn't that?
Like
Isabel
like,
Huppert, right? Or however you say her name.
I think it's just L.
Oh.
L.
L. Sorry.
But I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. What'd you think, Jared?
Thumbs up? Yeah.
I liked it.
I liked it a lot.
I mean, it's fucked up.
Yeah.
But I liked
that's pretty much what I was – that's the word I was trying to find earlier. Yeah. Fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anything else you guys want to bring up before we go into the mailbag?
I just wish that more people made movies like this, you know?
Me too.
Like
I know.
I don't know what it is. I guess that I heard that he watched a shitload of Rambo films to like get the pacing down for the American action flick, because that wasn't really like his shtick before this, right? So like there's something about the 80s and maybe let's say early 90s action films that they're so unique, and we can look at them as being like stupid stunt films or something like that. There's something really potent in them, you know? Like for some reason, even when I think of Stallone, I think of a film like Cliffhanger, which is not like his best film, but I fucking love that movie.
Yeah, movie
right?
rules.
Right? There's just something about even the like middle tier action films that is off. We watched a film the other day with fucking Pierce Brosnan. It was some direct to TV film. It was before he got cast in Bond. It was the same year that he made Mrs. Doubtfire. I can't remember what it's called. But it's Pierce Brosnan as a military dude, a part of some like transnational. It was made in like the early 90s, so after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it's like you got a team of like Soviets and Germans and English and all these different people coming together. And then, of course, they have to stop this runaway train. It's like this train that has a bomb on it or some shit like that. And it's not a good movie, but it's so fucking enjoyable at the same time.
I'm trying to look for IMDb, but when you were saying like no one really makes movies these days, I agree. Who would you say if anybody is like the Paul Verhoeven of now? Who could make these kind of very biting satires? I'm trying to rack my brain on anybody. I mean, but
I haven't seen Jojo Rabbit, but I mean,
you could see Taika. Yeah,
him
or James Gunn, maybe I could see something.
Yeah.
But yeah.
What's James Gunn? He's working on something next that's going to be really
Suicide
good.
Squad 2.
That's right.
You're thinking of the Detonator.
Is it Detonator?
Detonator. Yeah. Pierce Brosnan, 93, train with hostage in Berlin.
That's the one.
Germany. All right, I'm going to put my list.
Like even that, it's like it's silly, but there's something about those friggin' action films, and so many of them were made, and so many of them do not get the love because they're not prestige pieces, and I don't know, they don't have like special effects, and they're kind of like chintzy made, but I fucking love those things, you know? I mean, do you think, like, just in terms of action films, the Mission Impossible films might be still in that spirit, so right? They're still in that spirit because they do their own stunts. They use a lot of practical effects and things like that. Like, that's kind of, that's maybe the closest we get rather than everything being all CGI'd out, you know?
Well, wait, are you talking about now just in terms of action directors?
Yeah, now just action.
I don't see Christopher McQuarrie as really a satirist, you know?
No, now just the action.
Director of Mission Impossible. Okay.
Yeah. No, just action films now. Like even like the Bond films lately, like some of them kind of moved away. They were, some of them are really good, and some of them I think kind of get away from it. Like, I feel like even our action films, because they're so CGI heavy, that we just miss out on a lot of the kind of old badassery of blowing up miniatures and or blowing up real buildings. Like, whoa. Christopher Nolan, didn't he like buy a plane so we could blow it up in Tenet? Like, isn't that like?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Luckily, we have the.
Ridley did the same thing for The Dark Knight Rises, but
yeah,
the Raid guys and the John Wick guys are our saviors these days.
Yeah,
it kills me that the Raid 3 is not currently being worked on.
I know. What in the fucking hell, dude? They need to, it should be Raid 3 in
they
space.
They need to get on that. I know. All right. Let's go into the voicemails. We got one from Chris, but before we play that, if you guys want to send us a voicemail, it's 213-534-8807 or 21-ELF-HUT-07, where the elves party. Let's hear one from Chris.
Hey, Wisecrack, it's Chris here. Just got done listening to your Prestige podcast, and I have two quick questions. One, was Borden inspired by The Man with the Fishbowl? Because they were able to deduce pretty quickly that man pretty much lives his life as a cripple in order to hide that fishbowl under there. You know, they figured it out. The general audience doesn't know. Is that what Borden was inspired by in order to do his trick with his twin brother, like understanding that magic to keep the illusion is a lifestyle? And then the other one's also about Borden. It's only because I'm kind of a softie and was always really confused by this at the end. But when after Borden kills Engineer and goes to pick up, you know, what we perceive to be as his daughter, is that actually the girl's father or is it her uncle? Which brother died and which one got to live? Because it'd be even more messed up if the father had to die, which is why, you know, she went to see him in jail and that was his, like, final goodbye to her, you know, in order to maintain the illusion. It's crazy. I've always loved The Prestige and you guys did a great job talking about it. Thanks, bye.
All right, thanks, Chris. As far as the second question, I always took it as it was the father that died. Is that what you guys thought?
That's my take, too.
Yeah, I thought so, too, because that bit when Borden's in jail and he's saying, like, to take care of her, like, there's real panic. But then the question is this, is there a real distinction between him and his brother? Like, have they become so the same that between uncle and father, there's almost, like, he still loves her. I don't know. Like, maybe we're not supposed to know the answer. But you're right. I did, too. I always took it as the father. But I don't know if it's that clearly cut.
And as far as the first question, I always assumed that Borden was doing this probably from a much earlier age, that he's been doing the switcheroo game from even before. And I think it was his dedication that tipped him off into understanding that the fishbowl guy was just pretending to be disabled. At least that's how I took it.
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
All right, I want to go into our emails. I actually just want to hit one from Fernando. You can hit us up at movies@wisecrack.co. This is from Fernando. He also wants to talk about The Prestige. He says, I think something worth mentioning about this movie is the class struggle slash conflict. Borden slash Fallon is the everyman. All they have is their work and their bodies. Magic is the ticket out of poverty, and they pour everything into that. His tricks are technically simple and easy to duplicate as long as you're able to go through the same psychological and physical struggles they do. Their biggest official trick is based on their bodies, as in the unofficial trick, which is their biggest one, where the physically has to suffer via maiming and their entire family has to psychologically suffer as well. By dropping the act, they stand to lose not their work, but their lives. Angier is the rich man. Magic for him is a way to aggrandize himself, maybe to escape the shadow of his family's wealth and power, but his livelihood and his life do not depend on it. So much so, by the end of the movie, he quits once he has to achieve this goal and retires to his family's estate. His tricks are complicated and rely heavily on gadgets, most of which he has to buy or has assistants make instead of developing himself. As a rich man, he also has the means to influence and even destroy other people's lives. You guys joked about Elon Musk, which could be a good parallel to him. So, this is something that was like very subtly in the background of the movie that I hadn't really glommed onto, but I think that Fernando is right. Because, I mean, you know, as far as Angier kind of settling down to his estate toward the end of the movie, I always just assumed that he used the duplicator to duplicate money and be super rich. But there were some hints that, you know, he's got more means than Borden through, like Fernando mentioned, through the tricks that he has that are very mechanically oriented, and he's able to hire Michael Caine, and he's just generally dressed better throughout the movie.
And the name, the Great Danton, is kind of very aristocratic, right? And doesn't he kind of even say that to his wife at one point? And she's like, no, it's like dignified or whatever she says. And so he uses that, but there's something that there's like a connection, like maybe they're like rebels, like rebelling from the wealthy past or something along those lines. But I think Fernando's absolutely right, is self-aggrandizing is probably a good term, as we talked about this, is that's what he wants. He just wants the applause. He wants fame, adulation, affirmation, all that that comes with it. Whereas for Borden, it's the purity of the craft, right? He's a craftsman. And I think that's the difference. You know, he works hard because it's about grit, it's about effort, and it's about becoming the best through your effort. And rather than having stuff given to you just so you can kind of just take the easier road. Yeah.
Totally. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. But before we go, and you know what? Next week or in 2 weeks, fuck it. Let's keep this Verhoeven train running, man.
Dude, showgirls?
Yeah, let's do
it.
Shit.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Okay.
So, all right. Everybody join me and watch Showgirls. But before we leave, where can we find you guys on the internet? Austin.
Yeah, you can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I'm on Insta, AUS_HAY. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. I've got a YouTube channel where I upload videos, me talking about anything from reading through the Bible to political commentary, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm kind of all over.
And Ryan.
Twitter at Ryan's Game Show. And then on YouTube, Ryan's Game Show and Ryan Shorts. Every once in a while, baby. It's quarantine even more. And Showgirls in 2 weeks here on this channel.
Hell yeah. Rock and roll, guys. All right, we will see you in 2 weeks. Until next time, take us out, Ryan.
Goodbye from Memphis, Tennessee.
Peace.